From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ron Rash writes in the pared-down, cut-to-the-heart-of-things way that would light up any life, any part of the world. Ron Rash's world, in many years of short stories and novels, is Appalachia. He knows it well, he tells it, unfolds it powerfully. A lot of it is not pretty. The kids who give up college for meth, the man who searches for fortune in the graves of Confederate soldiers, the sister who turns her back on her brother who lost his leg so she has a chance at a better life. But there's beauty here too, the beauty of understanding, of really seeing. This hour on Point, writer Ron Rash. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you know Appalachia? Do you know the work of Ron Rash? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Cullowhee, North Carolina is Ron Rash, professor in Appalachian Cultural Studies at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee. His 2006 novel, The World Made Straight, just came out as a movie January 9th. His 2008 novel, Serena, will be released as a film in February, starring Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper, pretty hot names. His latest collection of short stories has received rave reviews. It's titled Something Rich and Strange. You can link to the first story in his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Janet Maslin at the New York Times says, you'd better believe Ron Rash belongs in the pantheon of great American writers. Ron Rash, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being here.
Good to be with you.
I'm sorry about our mix-up last week. We wanted to have you, and we had studio problems, and there you were, and we just couldn't make it happen. But thank you for coming in again. It's really wonderful to have you.
Glad to be with you.
You know, there's so much in here, and I can't wait to get into it. We want to talk about Appalachia in all kinds of ways, but let's just start literary. There's a lot of tough stuff in these short stories, and they stretch across many, many decades. I mean, even back and into the Civil War itself, and very up to date at the same time. I want to start looking at a story that I just found very beautiful. Second one in the collection, 3 a.m. and the stars were out. And you've got a couple of old soldiers here long ago who met in the Korean War. They're from Appalachia. Darnell, who's a farmer, Carson, who's a vet. Now they're old men. And Darnell calls Carson one night and needs him to come out because he's got a cow in the barn that just can't calve. The calf just, she can't get it out. And Carson comes out to help him. That's a setting that I know well from childhood. That's sort of middle of the night and a cow or you can't get the job done. And you put these old soldiers right in the middle of it with a kind of intimacy that most people wouldn't have. The vet, you know, you've got to go, as you write, Ron, you've got to go in with your whole arm up into the cow and get the calf sort of straightened out so it has a chance of coming out and then pull. But he sticks his thumb in the calf's mouth inside the cow to see if the calf will suckle, to know that it's alive and not already dead. I found myself asking at many points in this book, how did Ron Rash know that? As a farm kid, I knew that. But how did you know that that's what a vet would do way up in the uterus of a cow?
Well, it's good to have a large animal vet for a friend. That was helpful. But I did spend a lot of time on my grandmother's farm growing up. So I saw these things and was aware of them, not to the detail that obviously a veterinarian would know.
Take us into that story and what you wanted to convey about two old friends in the middle of the night pulling new life into the world.
Well, what I wanted to do, I think, was write a story about wonder and the fact that these men could bring this calf into the world, even late in their lives. They had lived very tough lives in many ways. They'd been in Korea. And as I get older, I realize that to be true to the world, I often sometimes write about the darker aspects, but also have to write about wonder. And I wanted a story where these men kind of went into a final battle or late battle in their lives and won.
I just love it. It's so beautiful. I know that sort of almost sacred, holy, magic aura that comes over after you've successfully brought that life out, and they do, and they get a chance to just be bathed in something luminous and wonderful one more time.
Yeah, and I think it's a story about how men love each other. These are men who would never use that word, but there's such a connection there, particularly when one of the farmers starts talking, talks to the vet about the loss of his wife. But it's in those quiet moments, and I think it's true to certainly the older men I knew growing up.
There's so much trouble in these stories, from Civil War through Depression and right up to date, meth labs, meth addicts, and all the rest. You do not hesitate from wading into it, and you do it with the very same kind of intimacy and insight you do in this story, 3M and the Stars Were Out.
Well, I'm very interested in what one writer said earlier, the idea of the hard considerations of the poor. And very often what I think makes such stories work when you have characters who are in such tough situations that the veneer falls away and they reveal who they really are. And sometimes to themselves, and I think that's very rich as far as literature, those moments.
Is it something universal? Do you see your readers responding to it in a universal fashion, recognizing how hard situations can be so revealing, or do they look at it as regional color?
They tend to look at it universal, and that's my hope. If my writing, if someone reads the work and just thinks, well, these are caricatures or these are mere exotics, I failed as a writer. Even though the culture is very different in some ways, ultimately my goal is to reveal something that is universal, that these people are, their concerns, love and fear and pity, all of those things are very human. So I've been very pleased with the response, particularly overseas, and readers, in a sense, talking about that very thing, that even though the landscape, the language was very different, that ultimately they understood these characters and their situations.
The terrain of the heart and soul is universal here. There is a geographic terrain as well. How do you picture your geographic terrain, Ron? Appalachia.
My family has very deep roots here, 200 years on both sides, so it's something that being very aware of that. But I'm also fascinated with how landscape impacts on human beings. As a matter of fact, in one of my novels, I actually say landscape is destiny. Mm-hmm. And part of that is, what is it about living in mountains that would make someone perceive the world differently? And even within my own family, I've sensed two things. One very positive, the idea of being protected by the mountains, almost a womb-like protection. But at the other end of it, sometimes like a kind of fatalism, in the sense that these mountains are so large and overwhelming that a human being is constantly reminded of how small and insignificant he or she is. Today people actually build houses on tops of mountains, but traditionally those homes would have been in the lower elevations, obviously, in the bottom land, and those people would have been, in a sense, just looking again and again at a kind of limitation.
Land, all rock and slant, you write about one Depression-era farmer's patch in your first story. You couldn't grow a toenail on Hartley's land. Just as tough as that. He's out harvesting Galex? I didn't even know what that was. What's Galex?
Oh, it's a plant. And actually, my mother, when she was growing up in western North Carolina, would harvest it and sell it. It was very often used for decorative purposes.
Florists or something would stuff it
right
in with a bouquet.
She actually did that as a child, and I'd always been kind of interested in that idea that it's like ginseng as well. People finding something out of that landscape very often because the landscape didn't allow the kind of large farms you might find in, say, the lower part of Mississippi or even in North Carolina.
It's a tough world you describe in that first story, Hard Times. Something is happening in the hen house, and eggs are being sucked dry, and that's a big deal. Each lost egg is a big deal in these Depression-era years. There is very stern drama in this story. At the end of it, you've got one of the farmers closing his eyes and trying to imagine a worse place than where he was. Wow, that's a tough banner to hang over a life, a place.
Well, it is, and there were moments like that for many people, obviously, but certainly in that region as well, in the height of the Depression. And I wanted that story to be very complex in the sense of, here's a good man trying to find a way of doing good in an awful time, and also knowing that there were things he couldn't control.
Yeah, plenty of things he couldn't control. He's got this one image as he's dreaming of men hanging onto boxcars while other men beat them with sticks, and the ones being beaten were farmers just like himself. Is there a persecuted or, you know, sought out for hard times complex here?
I think probably, at least for that character and the time setting, ultimately just a sense of reality, or at least his reality, the sense that the world was a tough place and that maybe this part of the world, because he didn't know any other, was the worst.
Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with writer Ron Rash about his moving, illuminating, troubling stories out of Appalachia. His latest collection, just published, is titled Something Rich and Strange. Behind me right here, Freebird from Lynyrd Skynyrd. It's a subject, or it's included in one of his stories called Waiting for the End of the World, where Amy Rowland writes the New York Times, "The clientele in this bar need that song, played every hour, the way diabetics need insulin." You can join us this hour. Do you know the stories of Ron Rash, the novels? Do they capture bigger truths about the heart up against trouble in Appalachia beyond? What about Appalachia itself? What's beautiful there? Its people? What's terrible there in the poverty, the hopelessness, the meth? What's your question this hour for Ron Rash? He joins us from Cullowhee, North Carolina today, a Carolina boy born and raised. Ron, you write in that story, Waiting for the End of the World, about Lynyrd Skynyrd. Skynyrd never pruned their southern musical roots to give them national appeal. Is that your style?
I would, in a sense. I think they're very true to their world, and it was very interesting that as we were going into the break, you played Earl Scruggs. I actually grew up in the same town as he did.
Foggy Mountain Breakdown, really? That was, you grew up in North, South Carolina, both?
Yeah, Boiling Springs, North Carolina.
But you say boiling as in boiling.
Yes, Boiling Springs.
Yeah, right.
Though the springs no longer boils because they tried to dynamite it to make it bigger. They thought they were going to have you know, something worthy of Yellowstone or, you know, Old Faithful or whatever.
And away it went.
It didn't work.
You said you worry about that with fracking these days.
Well, I am. And I think one aspect of Western North Carolina, it's such a beautiful place. I mean, there's no other place in the world I would want to live. And I plan to live here the rest of my life. But what I worry about is that we could lose some of that because of fracking in Western North Carolina. And it seems to me very obviously, even purely economically, that if you just leave the land alone, the tourism is going to pay off again. You know, you're going to make more money that way than risking destroying that very thing.
But that is not exactly the Appalachian story, is it? I mean, it's about taking down all the big trees to build cities. It's about taking the tops off the mountains to get the coal. It's about some pretty severe abuse of the land.
Unfortunately, it is. I think one aspect that does set the Appalachians region apart from maybe the rest of America is that more has been taken from it than given. And I would say not only natural resources such as coal and trees, but also even soldiers.
Yes, you write about that in this book. And, of course, if you think twice about it, we know it. But the what sort of per capita enlistment of young men and women out of Appalachia, maybe the highest in the country, You've got a story in here where you've got a family just kind of agog at how that's just their reality is not understood. They talk about war. People here know it intimately. So many have family in the middle of it when it's going on.
Right. And I think one of the tragedies of our what's happened as far as our fighting wars in the last decade has been that so many people in the country are impervious to the fact that these young people are going off and getting killed, suffering horrible injuries. And I personally wish that we had a draft. I think that would change a lot. And I do not say that lightly because I have a 25-year-old son.
Mm-hmm. You're a university professor. You've got a lot of people in your books who are not and have children off at war. What's your sense of how people in your neck of the woods see this issue? Is there a resentment that they fill the ranks of the military in such disproportionate numbers, or a sense of legacy, heritage, this is what we do?
I think it's both. I think there are, and I've seen this personally, a number of people I've known, young people, come back disillusioned from the war. But also I think there's a great pride in the region, patriotism, and it's like everywhere else. I mean, it's always difficult to generalize about a place, and I'm very careful about that because very often people think of Appalachia as mainly very poor, but there are places such as Asheville, North Carolina. But I think certainly
Asheville, which is the opposite of poor, which are pretty well healed lately.
Right, and there are those places. It's not all poverty. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be like going to the South Bronx and saying, oh, this is New York City. And I think we have to be very careful about that. But the people I'm interested in my work are the ones who very often have not had the breaks, who have been put in situations where I put them in situations mm-hmm. where they have to make tough choices. But I think that's where the conflict is where the drama of the stories occurs, and that we, you know, that's where it's, to me the heart of a story is conflict.
I love the particularity with which you bring those to life. They're anything but cliches. Ron Rash is with us. His new latest collection of short stories is Something Rich and Strange. Ron, lots of callers for you. Karen is calling for Columbia, South Carolina. Karen, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having one of my favorite writers, Ron Rash, on the program, Tom. Thank
Pleasure.
You so much.
Pleasure.
I was in Columbia when you read the veterinarian story, Ron, and thank you so much for it. It's just a great piece of work. What I was thinking about was there's a character that seems to run through everything you've written just about, and that's the economy of today. Certainly in Serena, you could see the backdrop of the economy, but it kept nagging at me and nagging at me that you really understand what the lie is about the New South for a whole lot of people. And it just seems to be the driving wheel that's underneath so much of the stories that you've written. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that. And the kids who are just, I mean, struggling like the devil to get out from under it. Please talk about that a little bit, and thank you for everything you've done.
Karen, thank you. Ron Rash, the lie of the New South versus Karen's pointing at an economic reality not so shiny.
I agree, and it's very unfortunate that it's that way. And I think like a lot of parts of the United States, one thing I've noticed in my own family is that I had an uncle who was a farmer, and he could barely scrape by. Another uncle worked for a furniture company, and now that's gone. So what happens to people? I mean, one of the questions I ask in my work is what happens to the people who had those jobs, who no longer can find those jobs, that no longer can farm the land? And I think those are incredibly important issues for us as a country. And that certainly is a major aspect of my work, I think, is what about the people who are forgotten? And I think it's so easy in this country sometimes to forget what is happening to so many people, you know, rural people.
We get a little flavor of that in, well, a lot in many of your stories, but there's one back of beyond. I wish you'd read a little bit for us here. There's a pawn shop owner, Parson. He goes on to have his own drama in this day, but at this point in the story, there's a woman desperate for money to support her drug habit that he's interacting with. Could you read for us, Ron?
Sure. Parson got out of his truck, unlocked the door, and cut off the alarm. He turned on the lights and walked around the counter, placed the loaded Smith & Wesson on the shelf below the register. The copper bell above the sill tinkled. The woman waited in the doorway, a wooden butter churn and dasher clutched in her arms. Parson had to hand it to them. They were getting more imaginative. Last week, the electric sign and false teeth. The week before, the four bicycle tires and a chiropractic table. Parson nodded for the woman to come on in. She set the churn and dasher on the table. "It's an antique," the woman said. "I seen one like it on TV, and the fella said it's worth $100. When the woman spoke, Parson glimpsed the stubbed brown ruin inside her mouth. He could see her face clearly now, sunken cheeks and eyes, skin pale and furrowed. He saw where the bones, impatient, poked at her cheeks and chin. The eyes glossy but alive, restless and needful. "You better find that fellow then," Parson said. "A fool like that don't come around often." "It's my great-grandma's," the woman said, nodding at the churn. "So it's near 75 years old. I guess I could take 50 for it." Parson looked the churn over, lifted the dasher, inspected it as well. An antique dealer in Asheville might give him 100. $20, Parson said. "The man on TV said..." "You told me," Parson interrupted. $20 is what I'll pay." The woman looked at the churn a few moments, then back at Parson. "Okay." She took the cash and stuffed the bills in her jeans. She did not leave. "What?" Parson asked. The woman hesitated, then raised her hands and took off her high school ring. She handed it to him, and Parson inspected it. "Class of 2000, the ring said. $10, he said, laying the ring on her side of the glass counter. She didn't try to barter this time, but instead slid the ring across the glass as if it were a piece in a board game. She held a finger on the ring a few moments before holding out her palm.
Ron Rash reading there from Back of Beyond, and it's early morning in a pawn shop, and you hear the exchange. Ron, meth plays a role in so many of these stories, meth and poverty, and they get all mixed up together. You know it well. I mean, you're describing it there. You don't say it straight out in this excerpt that you just read, but the stubbed brown ruin inside her mouth of her teeth, that is, her pallor, her eyes glossy but alive, restless and needful. These are all signposts of a meth user. There again, I wanted to ask, how did you get close enough to all that world to come to give us these very knowing descriptions?
Well, I think like most families in this region, I've been touched by it. I mean, not directly, but with a relative. But it's become, I think it ties into what the caller earlier said. I mean, what happens to people when the jobs disappear, when you own land, mountain land, you're not going to make enough money off farming it. And a kind of hopelessness comes about, I think. And I think those things are tied. And once again, I think the meth problem has been very underreported in the United States. And I think largely because it's a rural phenomenon. And certainly it's not just in Appalachia. Almost every rural area, such as Iowa, has this problem. And it's a very serious problem. It's a devastating drug. And what makes it even more horrific is, besides how addictive it is, it's also too easy to make. Almost anyone can make it.
Gary in Abilene, Texas. Gary, you're on with Ron Rash.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Ron. It is so good to hear this story, and I'm saddened to hear the things that are going on now. Ron, I am from Silva. I grew up there, spent the first 18 years of my life in Appalachia, Silva, Jackson County. I am a graduate of Cullowhee of Western Carolina University, and it is just a thrill to hear you talk about these things. I want you to know that I work in a library, and the public library in my town here has your newest book. I just put a hold on it so that it'll be coming to me in a day or two, and I will start reading the short stories in Something Rich and Strange.
You've got a great experience ahead of you there, Gary.
I want you to know something about my family. My dad was a doctor, a general practitioner. And in his day, he made house calls. And he would take his black bag when somebody called, whatever time of day or night it was, and go out and help these people. And one thing about my father was, he did not care if you paid, how you paid, or when you paid. I remember him coming home with sacks of things that people used to pay him that came out of their gardens.
Yeah, well, the first story in the book I think you will identify with, because this veterinarian very often goes out late at night knowing very well he may not get paid, mm-hmm. but he does it as, you know, it's just that he's a remarkable man. It's not ultimately about getting paid. It's about trying to do good in the world.
In the story, Gary, I appreciate your call so much. Ron, in the story we just heard you read from, it gets fairly ugly. The pawn shop owner goes out and he finds that his brother's been run out of his own house by his son, who's a meth addict and living out in an ice-cold trailer with his wife, afraid to go in because the drugged-up son has become menacing. It gets tough. And his brother Ray says, near the end of that story, "I never thought things could ever get like this. This world, I just don't understand it no more." Appalachia, as you have it, has known hard times for a long time. Worse or better or just different today?
I think in some ways I see signs of hope. I mean, one aspect I'm very excited about, because several young people I know are starting to do organic farming in the region. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are reasons to have hope. And I think at the same time, it has been very often a tough world. I mean, I know this from my family's experience, stories I heard, you know, going back to the Civil War. So I think part of what I want to do is, you know, remind people how heroic these people can be as well. For instance, the story you mentioned about the guy I just read, the pawn shop owner, mm-hmm. he ultimately does a very brave and noble thing. Mm-hmm. And what I've tended to do in my stories, I tend not to write directly about the meth addicts or the oxycodone accidents. Mm-hmm. I write about the people around them, the people that are suffering. But also, I think one aspect of what I write about in several stories in Rich and Strange is people who have grown up in this traditional community watching the world become totally alien to them. Not just the drugs, but the idea that the way of life they had as farmers, for instance, is completely gone.
Ron Rash, please stand by there in Cullowhee, North Carolina. It is so good to have you. The new collection of short stories is Something Rich and Strange. Here's Steve Earle with Copperhead Road. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I've done 2 tours of duty in Vietnam. I came home with a brand new plane. I take the seat from Colombia, Mexico. I just planted up a hotter down Copperhead Road. And now the DA's got a chopper in it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with Ron Rash about his moving, illuminating, troubling stories out of Appalachia. His latest collection is Something Rich and Strange. You can read a bit from it at our website, onpointradio.org. It is pretty terrific. He joins us today from Cullowhee, North Carolina. The film Serena comes out next month, based on his 2008 novel by the same name. George and Serena Pemberton, played by Bradley Cooper, big right now. Jennifer Lawrence, big right now. They launch a timber empire. They're tough. She's tough. Here's Serena, Jennifer Lawrence, visiting workers and taking charge.
How's everything going?
Well, it's be expected, man.
Don't notch so high. You're wasting a foot of timber.
Any lure won't fall here, ma'am. Yonder's in the way.
Give me your axe.
Ma'am.
You heard me.
Jennifer Lawrence in Serena with Bradley Cooper comes out next month from the novel of Ron Rash. Short story collection front and center this time. Ron, lots of readers who have read it and very happy for it. Amelia writes to us on Facebook, hallelujah, just to have it. Kevin says he's a poet. Susan says, a midway through this collection, great stories and wonderful writing. Krieger writes to us on our website, says, give the country another 50 years, Appalachia will basically be any area outside cities and other centers for jobs. Oh, boy. Do you see things that way, Ron?
I worry about that. I mean, one thing that we do know now is that people, particularly people who are doing well, are moving back into the cities. And I worry about the fact that there are going to be these vast places where people are neglected. And so I think that's a legitimate fear to worry about what happens to the rural poor.
Read these stories well, my friends. Matthew in Ponca City, Oklahoma. Matthew, you're on the air with Ron Rash.
Thank you.
What are you thinking?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You're on, Matthew. What are you thinking?
I just wanted to point out his story about the two gentlemen and the calf. It really made me think of my grandfather. My grandfather is soon to be 80. He is a Korean War veteran himself. He was born in Alabama. He moved to Tulsa. And the line he said about these two men who love each other but would never use that word, it really struck me because I'm 24, and every day I saw my grandfather until I was about 20, he would always tell me, be safe, was the last thing he would always say to me. And he still says it. And when I was 20, it struck me as that's his way of saying, I love you and I care about you and I want you to be well. And though, I mean, he could give you a definition of those terms, but that they're not in his vernacular. And I really, I'll be honest, I've never heard of Mr. Rash beforehand, but I'm looking forward to finding some of his material and getting into it because it's really striking a chord with a lot of people that I think a lot of writers don't really realize exist in a way.
Yeah.
It sounds awkward, but
No, it's. I think you put your finger right on it, Matthew, and I appreciate your call. Thank you. In Ponca City, Oklahoma, Ron Rash, there's a lot that doesn't exactly get said in your stories. There's one, Those Who Are Dead and Only Now Forgiven. These two bright young kids coming out of high school, Lauren and Jody, headed off to college, and they end up at the wrong end of the road in a meth house. You think it's all going to work, and then it just doesn't, and it ends up happening that way, kind of. Ultimately, without a word, there's just a kind of silent surrender here. I had to really stretch to feel exactly what it was that brought the full surrender to bear. How do you go from being, you know, these were the exceptional ones on the up path, on the high path, up and out maybe of trouble, and the moment where they both shift onto the downward path is so subtle. How do you know when the tumbler clicks that way?
I think one of the great things about writing literary fiction is I can assume my audience's intelligence. I don't have to beat them over the head. So that's one aspect of it. But I think, you know, those characters do represent, particularly, I think one aspect we don't talk a lot about in the United States is class.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whatever color or gender, there still are class divisions in this country. And it's very difficult sometimes if you are in that class where there are so few expectations to get out. And I actually saw that in my own family. Certainly my parents ultimately both became teachers, but they started off working in a cotton mill. And just through incredible grit and courage went back. My father had actually dropped out of high school,
mm-hmm.
went back, ultimately became a university or college teacher. And my mom went back when she was in her 30s and got her degree. And So it's difficult, but those people can get out at times, but there are some that don't.
It can hinge on such subtle things. You've got Lauren, the young woman who goes early to the meth house here. Jody, you think through this story, he's going to make it. He's you know, off to college, and he's up and out. But at some point, he just decides, and it's a subtle calculus, to throw his lot with her, with that scene, maybe you could say with his class, and stay there. There's a lot of talk about what it takes to get people hooked into opportunity and up and out, but the subtlest things, well, they're not. It doesn't mean they're not strong, but they can be subtle that pull people down.
Oh yeah, and I think in that particular story, what he knows and knows not just because he's done very well in high school, and now he is in college, mm-hmm. but he just knows how much he's still got to go. He's worried about student loans. And also, he feels adrift. I mean, this one young woman that he's loved in his life. And I see that story ultimately as a tragic love story.
Yes. Absolutely. Ellie in Medina, Ohio, you are on with Ron Rash. Ellie, thanks for calling.
Thank you. And, Ron, I have to tell you, first of all, I read Serena. I love Serena. It is one of my all-time favorites. I think the way that you chose her name is such an irony. You know, if there's somebody who I wouldn't picture as serene, it would be that woman.
A woman who gets very tough in the lumber business. And
oh, she's the B word, but we won't go there. There is a quote that, as I was leading book clubs with Serena, I found that I think is perfect. The earth we abuse and the living things we kill in the end take their revenge and exploiting their presence, we are diminishing our future. And that's a quote from 1958. And I think it's so very true how they raped the land and just, you know, and what are we doing everywhere? You are such an excellent writer. And what a bead you have on human character and behavior. The other thing about your book, Serena, is that as a former English teacher, we kept seeing and reading the three lumbermen talking, and it was so much like a Greek chorus in the old classic plays,
yes.
Where the chorus would let us know more than we knew. You're just wonderful. Thank you so much. thank you.
Ellie, thank you. Ron, you've got good readers. You've got great readers. Thank you so much, Ellie in Medina. Let me get one more, if I may, Ron, from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Marty, you're on.
Hi, Tom and Hi. Ron. I'm delighted to have a chance to listen to Ron. I just love the compassion that Jody shows in Those Who Are Dead Are Only Now Forgiven. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that so often in your short fiction, characters sacrifice for others or even pay for others' sins. And that offers a real contrast to Flannery O'Connor's fiction, even though your work resembles hers and pays tribute to hers in many ways. So I'm wondering if you would say that in 2015, Christ has abandoned the South that paid for sins in O'Connor's South.
Bringing Flannery O'Connor's Catholicism forward there. Okay, Ron, what, characters pay for each other's sins in your fiction, perhaps, in Flannery O'Connor's? Take it to the Lord.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting idea. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think very often what I am interested in very often is people, putting people in my stories, sometimes my novels, who are willing to sacrifice themselves for others. O'Connor remains one of my favorite writers, I would say that. But in some ways, important ways, I think we're very different. And I think what she's talking about perhaps is part of that.
Amy Rowland talks about other writers when she looks at your work. Eudora Welty, she quotes, thinking about what we can learn from these Appalachian stories. One place comprehended can make us understand other places better. Welty, of course, wrote. But Amy compares you more closely. She says you're more reminiscent of the best Midwestern writers, particularly Willa Cather. How does that sit with somebody who's writing about the hollers here? Not many hollers in the Midwest.
Well, I think And I actually love Willa Cather's work. I think they're writers who I don't like the term regional. I think sometimes because I think it implies a limitation. But and it's also kind of funny because no one seems to view say a Richard Price novel as regional.
Right. Who's not regional in some, of course, yes.
Right, but I love Richard Price's work. He's one of my favorite living writers. But I think the idea that place is important, that place becomes a character, sometimes almost an overwhelming presence in my work is certainly true. But as I say, I see it no more limiting than James Joyce writing about Dublin, just that one little area of Dublin in Ulysses.
And on this issue of who accounts for what and sacrifice, you mentioned you've got a story called Blackberries in June, where it's complicated. You've got a young couple and they're making some progress. They've got a house on the lake. They're sort of getting up and out just a little bit from the hardest times. And then there's an accident, logging, and a leg is going to be lost. And the parents come in and suggest that those who are getting up and out may have to sacrifice that for a brother and sister-in-law who are now in trouble. And the mother tells her daughter, you can't expect miracles in this life, girl. You've got to do what's best for the whole family. You've got to accept that life is full of disappointments. That's something you learn as you grow older. Truth in that, but the girl does not want to hear it, Ron, as young people do not want to hear it. And she won't pick up the sacrifices laid in front of her, I guess.
Right. She ultimately makes that decision that she's worked hard for her, to achieve a certain level of comfort, and that she's not willing to give that up along with her husband. And yet at the same time, and I think that's where the heart of the story is, the human heart, just that horrible decision that she's going to have to make. Do I leave these people behind that I love to achieve this life that I have worked so hard for, or do I fall back?
A situation in which people in a lot of parts of the country have also found themselves, and maybe increasingly. Lisa in Charleston, South Carolina, you're on.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on.
Okay. Hi, Ron. This is not a literary question. I'm calling because I'm a former student of yours. You were my teacher at Tri-County Tech in 1991, and I was one of those people that you're kind of talking about. I was a high school dropout and decided to go to college at the age of 30, and I probably would not have stuck with it if you had not been one of my very first professors, and you really taught me a love of school again. Everything I'd hated before, I grew to love. And I just have always wanted the opportunity to say thank you for that. And I went on. I did not stay in writing, but I did go on and get my master's at Clemson and became a psychotherapist. And I truly believe that I owe it to you because you were my inspiration. I thought, why is this amazing guy teaching at this little school? and now I know why. It's because you cared about people like me, and I just appreciate that.
Tri-County Tech, and it worked. Lisa, you make it so real. That's wonderful. Thank you. Ron, you saved one right there.
Well, that's a wonderful compliment. I'm so happy for her. And I did teach 17 years at a community college. Mm. And I had so many students who came back sometimes in their 30s and 40s. They'd lost jobs. The cotton mill had closed down. And those students were so hungry. And I think as tough as the job was, I taught sometimes five classes, sometimes even six. But I got to deal with people who were trying. We're kind of caught in those tough situations, and I've been so pleased to see so many of them that went through that two-year program at Tri-County who have become, really good jobs, such as Lisa, and they've become teachers. And that's one of the most rewarding aspects about teaching at a community college, or I taught 2 years of high school as well, is that you have a chance to. You hope that you can have an impact on some of your students.
Lisa, thank you so much for your call. Just terrific to have you. Still thinking of that line, that farmer's dream. Dreaming of men hanging onto boxcars while other men beat them with sticks. Those beaten were farmers like himself out of depression years in Appalachia. Ron Rash brings it right up to date. Ron, it was terrific talking with you. This is just a wonderful collection of stories, something rich and strange. Thank you very, very much for joining us and chatting for a little while today.
It's been a pleasure.
Ron Rash, joining us from Cullowhee, North Carolina. Thank you, Ron. Behind us here, we'll go out with Doc Watson, Poor Wayfaring Stranger. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Where weary eyes no more shall weep. I'm going there to see my Savior, who shed for me his precious blood. I'm just a going over Jordan. I'm just a going.